Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another one of our Urbanite Radio stories. And Halloween is upon us. And inside this edition of Urbanite is a story by Andrew Reiner, who's a professor of literature and English at Towson University and is also a writer. And he wrote the article, Telltale Smackdown. Who wrote the best Halloween story? Edgar Allan Poe or Washington Irving? Maybe sacrilege for some Baltimore people, but Andrew, welcome. Good to see you, man.
Good to see you too, Mark.
Here we have Baltimore, as you write in the beginning of this, that all these cities where Poe lived, Philly, Baltimore, Boston, Richmond, everybody's claiming Edgar Allan Poe is theirs, and they're all celebrating his 200th. I mean, it's something to celebrate. He's a great poet and writer and one of America's greatest, but you have a challenge to Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And this is the turf to do it on. You know what I'm saying?
So what is the challenge? I mean, tell me how you came to why you took so much umbrage at people kind of focusing on Poe.
You know, it's funny. I mean, at first it had nothing to do with Edgar Allan Poe. It had everything to do with Halloween and Washington Irving. But also, I mean, I'm not going to lie. The more I learn about Poe, the more it does become a little bit of an issue with the guy who was Poe, you know? But it's mostly about Halloween, and it's mostly about Washington Irving's kind of lost place, you know, in our, I wouldn't say our canon, but kind of in as the importance of in American literature, and especially, I think, in the type of, I mean, I've always lumped Washington Irving in, probably out of my own ignorance, as kind of like a Halloween type of writer. And I think that the thing that as Americans, not just Baltimoreans, but as Americans, that we tend to, when we think of Poe, we think of, you know, we think of The Raven.
Right.
Right? We think of Telltale Heart, Follow the House of Usher. We think of a lot of his stories that are either the detective short stories, or we tend to think of Poe really as kind of like the seminal kind of scary writer. And I think he, you know, I think Poe serves his place. I think he serves his purpose. But I think that Washington Irving was the forerunner of all this, and I think he did it better than anyone.
There's a couple of things here. Let's just parse them out a little bit. I mean, first of all, you have Poe is the great mystery writer, though. The people talk about Poe, people who are mystery writers like our own Laura Lippman and others write about Poe as an inspiration and somebody who is the father of a genre in some senses of great mystery writing.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, absolutely. And there's a new collection of short stories that came out in honor of Poe's 200th birth, the 200th anniversary of his birth. And no, none other than Stephen King, you know, writes one of the essays about, you know, the brilliance of Telltale Heart. And everybody always defers to Poe. And I think when it comes to that genre of mystery, I mean, he is kind of the you know, the grandfather of that genre. And when it comes to detective stories, too, I just don't think he deserves the mantle that he's been given when it comes to the writer we go to, the go-to writer for Halloween.
All right, let's talk about that part of it. I mean, because you see Washington Irving as the one connected to the real scary stories, the real heart of Halloween that comes out of the ancient Celtic and Catholic traditions. You see, that is Washington Irving, not Poe.
Right, exactly. I mean, Poe is all about scare factor. You know, when Poe was writing, one thing I learned about Poe recently is that Poe was not so much invested in a lot of his stories as much as he was in getting paid, and so that he wasn't eating molasses and bread all the time. You know, I mean, he was a literary mercenary. He did what he had to do so that he could make ends meet because the guy lived destitute a lot of his adult life. Mm-hmm. And so apparently a lot of what the kind of writing he was doing was stuff that he was doing on the fly. And it was a way of getting paid and a way of just, you know, that's how he refused to take on other kinds of jobs. And I think that if he could come back and see the reputation he has, not so much for the mystery writing and for the detective writing, but for everything that's being read at Halloween, I think he would think, yeah, I deserve this being the guy that he was. But I also think that if he was really honest with us, he would say, you know, I did a lot of this as hack work. It was a way to get paid. It was a way to get quick money and a turnaround. And I don't think that Poe really, the kind of writing that he was doing for this, and he wasn't, of course, writing scary stories for the sake of scary stories. This was a part of who he was. But it was a part of his sensibilities. But I don't think that Poe being Poe was really invested at all in the larger kind of tapestry that I think Washington Irving creates in his writing. Washington Irving, one of the things I talk about in the piece is how Washington Irving really mines sense of place. That is not something that Edgar Allan Poe ever really pays attention to. And when you're a good Halloween story, when you think about the best Halloween stories that we know of, even in children's books, there's always this kind of mystical, magical environment in which they take place because it's the possibility that something like this could happen. And that's what we love. And Washington Irving, I think more than most American writers, past or present, mined sense of place and had an incredible feeling for sense of place that just adds so much more to the possibility of this magic.
Before you read and give our listeners a feel for the spookiness of Washington Irving's writings and how he grabs you, tell us, a lot of people don't even know who he was anymore. I mean, you know, we talked about before we came in the studio,
right,
that when you think of, everybody knows the name Washington Irving. People just know the name.
Right.
Who is he? I don't know. He's Washington Irving.
Right.
And then people know the Headless Horseman. That's become part of American lore, but all we know is it's some scary guy riding down the road with no head in Halloween.
Right.
And we know the name Ichabod Crane, because it's a name out of literature, but we never connect them. We don't know what they all mean. So he's in some ways been lost, even though he may be considered, as you consider him, the father of American literature and writing in many ways. But we don't know who he was. We've kind of forgotten about it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Washington Irving.
Absolutely, and you and I were talking about that. Washington Irving really was the kind of the first pen of American letters. In the early 19th century, when really in order to get any kind of credibility as a writer, you had to make it across the pond over in London, and that was just the way it was. And nobody in this country was really taken seriously as a writer, and that was mostly because when it came to art, especially to art and to writing. You had to be taken seriously over in Europe, and especially when it came to writing over in England. And very few artists of all colors, as far as, you know, different types of genres, were all art forms, very few were taken seriously. And Washington Irving was the first writer in America that really made a splash over in London, and a lot of great writers really considered this is the first really big thing over in the States. And he earned it. And
he was big in his time.
He was huge in his time. And actually, what a lot
of
people...
Which was what, the 1700s?
This would have been the early 19th century. So it would have
early
been the
1800s.
Early 1800s,
right,
exactly.
Right.
And so Washington Irving, you know, he develops this reputation, and justifiably so. And the proof is in the pudding with a guy like Irving. Because you look at none other than our Poe, guys like Hawthorne, Nathaniel Hawthorne, guys like Herman Melville.
Great writers. I love Melville. I love Melville.
I mean, these guys are still, especially Melville, right, are still held as just, you know, just geniuses today, you know, in the American canon. So they all really looked up to Irving, and they all sought him out in different ways. Poe even wrote about Irving and considered him very much kind of a mentor. When Poe was really cutting his teeth, was trying to get a leg up with his publishing career, he sought Washington Irving out to get some advice and to see if Washington Irving would speak up on behalf of Poe's reputation and help him out with his work and that kind of thing. So,
did he?
To some extent, he did. He did. You know, he was to the extent that Poe wanted some advice or maybe some entree, Washington Irving gave him what he asked for. And so he really was the first American writer that was really taken seriously abroad and as a result here in the States. And then, so of course, a lot of young writers looked at him. A lot of these young Turks looked to Irving as this kind of like avuncular figure that could help them out with their own careers. And when he could, he did, to his credit.
So give us a sense of Washington Irving. The two books he's most famous for are Sleepy Hollow. And
we all think of Rip Van Winkle.
Rip Van Winkle.
Which actually were all part of what was called the sketchbook. And they were actually short stories that were part of his sketchbook that he became probably best known for. Washington Irving was really best known as a satirist. And what a lot of people don't realize is that Sleepy Hollow, as Rip Van Winkle and Sleepy Hollow were both satires, Sleepy Hollow is probably even more of a satire than even Rip Van Winkle was. And a lot of people don't realize that. He was really, and that's one of the things that Poe liked a lot about a guy like Washington Irving. Washington Irving was a satirist, but he didn't do it, he didn't have a mean-spirited way about going about it. Poe, on the other hand, really apparently had a lot of contempt for his readers. And looked down upon a lot of who his public was. Irving wasn't like that. Irving was well educated as a lawyer. He was a diplomat. Spent a lot of time abroad. But he also didn't have this kind of contempt. He didn't look down on his readers. He knew who buttered his bread, and he understood that. He appreciated that.
One of the things that you wrote about in your article was that. That Irving, as you write, you wrote that he invokes the Halloween's pagan early Christian roots, the Samhain tradition of the Celts and the All Souls Day of the Catholics, and then when the dead returned on that hallowed eve and come back to the land, that's the spirit that he wrote about.
He does, and that's another aspect of, in addition to the whole thing about mining this sense of place and the mysticism of that. Even though Washington Irving probably wouldn't have articulated it that way, he probably wouldn't have said, "Oh yeah, you know, when I was writing, you know, I was making this connection to Samhain and to the pagan, you know, the early Celts." But it's there because it's not directly there. But Irving had spent a lot of time over in Germany and was influenced by the Grimms. And if you look back at a lot of that literature, there is a connection to a lot of the archetypes, mm-hmm. and a lot of the kind of mythology that comes up and swirls around a lot of these pagan images and icons, and a lot of the ways that was being celebrated, and Irving picks up on that. Whether it's direct or indirect, he picks up on that, and he brings that whole feel and kind of sensibility into a lot of his stories. They're not as harsh. His stories, of course, aren't as harsh. They're soft pedaled. They're much rounder and softer than the Grimm stories are. But Irving appreciates, I think he really picked this up in Germany, these old Dutch wives, you know, sitting in front of the hearths. Telling these stories, because as far as these denizens of Sleepy Hollow are concerned, everywhere they go, everything they do, there's superstition, and any time they see a light, and any time there was they passed the tree in the story of Sleepy Hollow where Major Andre had been hanged, who actually was a real figure in American history, there's ghosts everywhere, and it's that whole notion with Samhain of when. You have the spirits from the previous year, you know, you have the dead who have passed, their spirits all come back, and that mystical hinge, which is autumn. And that's very pagan. It's that whole notion that October 31st, November 1st, in the pagan calendar, that's the new year. That's when there's this mystical hinge, when things happen that ordinarily wouldn't happen during the rest of the year. And Washington Irving knows that it's autumn. This is He understands that intuitively, that autumn is that mystical time. It's the same thing in Rip Van Winkle. It's not a coincidence that, you know, when Rip Van Winkle goes up into the Catskills, it's in autumn. That's when he encounters the spirit of Hendrik Hudson and his men. And he understands that's the dying time. And it's the time when there's a possibility of anything eerie, if anything paranormal, supernatural is going to happen. That's it.
It happens then.
Absolutely.
It happens now.
Absolutely. Thank God it does.
This is the time.
Absolutely.
This is the time.
Amen.
So what are you going to read for us?
I'm going to read you a little passage from The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And I'm going to stay away from the scene that everybody knows best, which of course is when, if we know of a scene from the story, it's when the main character, Ichabod Crane, encounters who what he thinks to be is the Headless Hessian or the Headless Horseman. This is a scene where Ichabod Crane is leaving. It's right before he supposedly encounters the Headless Horseman. And he's leaving this quilting frolic that has been going on at Baltus Van Tassel's house. And he throws this big autumn party, this quilting frolic, and which was a very common form of like a party back then. And he's leaving it. And he's just been turned down. He has made some advances to who he thought was going to, hoped he was going to be his wife, the daughter of Baltus Van Tassel. Katrina Van Tassel, who is this, you know, coy little coquettish woman who stood to inherit a lot. Ichabod Crane wanted to get in on that. And apparently he was turned down. So he's leaving. Everyone else is gone for the night. He's got to travel the dirt back roads of Sleepy Hollow back to wherever it is that he's staying for the night. And this is a guy who keeps his eyes and his nose in a book of witchcraft all the time anyway. So this is somebody who believes firmly with every fiber of his being that what lies out there, the sounds that he hears, the lights that he sees, that this is all about the supernatural. So this is kind of setting the tone for leading up to his encounter with the Headless Horseman.
Okay.
It was the very witching time of night that Ichabod, heavy-hearted and crestfallen, pursued his travel homewards along the sides of the lofty hills which rise above Tarrytown and which he had traversed so cheerily in the afternoon. The hour was as dismal as himself. All the stories of ghosts and goblins that he had heard in the afternoon now came crowding upon his recollection. The night grew darker and darker. The stars seemed to sink deeper in the sky, and driving clouds occasionally hid them from his sight. He had never felt so lonely and dismal. He was, moreover, approaching the very place where many of the scenes of the ghost stories had been laid. In the center of the road stood an enormous tulip tree, which towered like a giant above all the other trees of the neighborhood and formed a kind of landmark. Its limbs were gnarled and fantastic, large enough to form trunks for ordinary trees, twisting down almost to the earth and rising again into the air. As Ichabod approached this fearful tree, he began to whistle. He thought his whistle was answered. It was but a blast sweeping sharply through the dry branches. As he approached a little nearer, he thought he saw something white hanging in the midst of the tree. He paused and ceased whistling, but on looking more narrowly, perceived that it was a place where the tree had been scathed by lightning and the white wood laid bare. Suddenly, he heard a groan. His teeth chattered and his knees smote against the saddle. It was but the rubbing of one huge bough upon another as they were swayed about by the breeze. He passed the tree in safety, but new perils lay before him.
You gonna leave us hanging there?
Oh, yeah. You know as well as I do, Mark. Any good story, man. What's, you know, you got to have that tension for the reader.
All right. So on this Hallowed Eve, in our Urbanite radio story here with Andrew Reiner, you're setting up that Washington Irving is the true father of Halloween scary stories and not Edgar Allan Poe.
Yes, absolutely. It is. I would still maintain, despite what I'm sure a lot of Baltimoreans would say, that it is Washington Irving. And again, it's not so much about the scare factor. It's about other aspects of what Halloween is really about. You know, it's not just the slice and dice Friday the 13th mentality.
Mm-hmm.
That's just really kind of the modern incarnation of it. You know, it's Halloween for people who really appreciate it. People who really appreciate it know what I'm talking about. It's, you know, this is an autumn festival. And the autumn festival has many aspects, many components to it. And one of them is this appreciation of this shifting of seasons, the outer shifting of seasons and the inner shifting of seasons. And, you know, the shortening days, the darkening nights, and all that, the absence of light, all what that means and what that connotes. And that's the beauty of a time like this. And I think Washington Irving, better than a lot of even modern day American horror writers, he understood that.
Well, let's hope everybody goes back and reads some Washington Irving. Antirana, thanks so much. It's great to have you here.
Good to see you, Mark.
All right,
thanks.
You too. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producer is Justin Levy. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman, and our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gabe Pinder, and Devin Finley. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.